Welcome to Survival Mode Disrupted, the podcast for those who are done performing, done people pleasing, and done living life on autopilot. I'm your host, Leticia, the Survival Mode Disruptor, and this is where we create disruptive, unapologetic transformations for those who are ready to exit survival mode and reclaim their power. Every episode is your permission slip to burn the rule book, break the cycle, and finally build a life that feels like yours. So let's disrupt everything that's holding you back and start living life on your own terms. This is your trigger warning. This podcast is raw. It is real, and it doesn't sugarcoat what it means to survive trauma, abuse, mental health battles, or even the aftermath of living in survival mode for too damn long. What you hear on Survival Mode Disrupted includes unfiltered stories, graphic details, and a vulnerable truth that may trigger some of the audience. Please prioritize your emotional safety. If something feels too heavy, pause. Breathe. Come back when you're ready or not at all. Your healing is yours to honor. These episodes are based on lived experience, not therapy sessions or clinical advice. Listening does not replace mental health treatment or constitute a coach-client relationship. If you're in crisis, please seek immediate help from a licensed professional or contact your local emergency services. This space is built with care, but it's also built for truth and built for disruption. Take what you need, leave the rest, and most of all, trust yourself. If this podcast speaks to your soul, you don't have to do this work alone. Feel free to join our free Facebook community for high-achieving women ready to break cycles and heal out loud. Join us at Disrupting Survival Mode on Facebook. Or grab the book that started this movement, Exiting Survival Mode, a raw step-by-step guide to help you identify, release, and rebuild from the survival patterns that have been keeping you stuck. Hello, 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 and welcome back to another episode of Survival Mode Disrupted. I am your host, Leticia, the Survival Mode Disruptor, and today we have Jackie. Jackie, why don't you introduce yourself?
Hey, everybody. My name is Jackie Grillon, and I am nothing if not a survival disruptor myself.
I love that. Jackie, Miss Survival Disruptor, why don't you tell us your story to and through survival mode?
All right. Well, I hope your audience is ready. All right. So listen, I was born and thought like, you know, my whole life was normal and realized a lot later that it was anything but normal. I have been abused pretty much in every way possible, shape, or form. When I was somewhere between 3 and 5, I was sexually abused by my grandfather. My mom was abused as well. And so you can see how the unhealed pathology of our ancestral lineage has been passed down. And you know, so when you're dealing with people who are unconsciously passing down all of these things and not able to heal from those things, it's inevitable that's going to happen to you. You know, being raised with that, you know, my dad yelled and screamed a lot and things like that, and they fought, and my mom would kind of leave the room when my dad would, you know, line us up to spank us and things like that. And like, I think that was her way of like, I don't, you know, out of sight, out of mind. I don't want to, you know. My mom was unable to deal with her own issues. And because of her own issues, she needed a placeholder, and I was the firstborn, so I was the placeholder for all my mom's unhealed pain, unfortunately, and probably my dad's as well. You know, his was just quieter. He was louder in the, he had a lot of rage, and so I definitely absorbed that, and I absorbed my mom's pain and rage. And so absorbing all of that as a child is just like too much for anybody to bear. And then, of course, the gaslighting and the what have you, like I said, my mom was unable to deal with that. So I, you know, was questioning my own sanity growing up, and that's not good for a child. And then at the age of six, I went to Catholic school. And back then, before DIFAS and DFS or whatever they call it, wherever you are out in, you know, internet land, the when your parents pay to go to private religious Catholic school, you were basically paying to have your children hit, whipped, beaten, hair pulled, shamed in front of the whole school. And that was my experience there. And so that was not a fun time. I mean, just little things like the teacher, like, you know, if a kid made a noise, you know, like kids do in third grade, you know, the nun would turn around and be like, "Who did that?" And of course, nobody's going to say anything. And then it would be like, "Sit there with a sin in your soul," like things like that. And it sounds minor, but when you're coupling that with everything else going on in your life, it's just a lot. So I was in survival mode probably before I came out of the womb because my mom was in survival mode. And my mom was in survival mode until the day she passed. You know, my mom did 40 million years of therapy, but never got better. And she was definitely undiagnosed with lots of things. I'm 58 years old. And I've only recently been diagnosed with ADHD. That's how much we didn't talk about those things. You had to suck it up back then. You know, that's what it was. You just had to double down and just keep going. And you didn't talk about things or work through things. That's just kind of how it went. So, of course, that led me into dissociating from my body and then medicating with everything I could medicate with to not have to feel any of the things that were just too big for me to feel, you know. So that's where drugs and alcohol came in. That led to all kinds of things. I had a child, and I feel like I was good for a while with my child, and then my addictions started to kind of ramp up. And then when you cross the line, you cross the line, and then that's the end of that. My parents took custody. My parents were divorced, but my stepmother and my dad took custody of my son, and it was supposed to be temporary custody. And yeah, that temporary thing never happened. So 3 years after I got sober, I was financially, emotionally, and you know, mentally ready to take my son, and I went to go sit down with my stepmother because my dad doesn't do those conversations. And she was like, "Oh, well, we're ready to keep him," and you know, all of that. And I was like, "Well, that's great." And I'm like, "But there's no judge in the world that's going to keep me from my son now," versus before, every judge would have kept me from my son. So signing temporary custody at that time was the most responsible thing I did before I got sober, even though it was the most heartbreaking thing I ever did. But when I was 3 years sober, I said, "That's it. I'm going to take him." By the time I was done with the conversation with her, there was no way I was letting her keep my child, kind of thing, because that's how I felt, like she was keeping my child from me. And that's kind of what was happening. And I had no say in my own child's life. And there's nothing more heartbreaking than having zero say in your watching somebody else raise your child and you have zero say over it, because that is not what I signed up for. And so at the end of the conversation, though, call it God, universe, whatever you believe in, I decided that I was going to put my needs aside and do what was best for my son at the time. And by this time, he was around 10 or 11 years old. So he was old enough to make that choice. I was still rebuilding trust with him and everything else. And I wanted him to feel safe about his decision. And let's face it, he's only lived in the one place for most of his life. And so I wanted him to have a say in that. And he chose to stay with them. And from that point on, we would have sit downs and it would be sort of like co-parenting. Like I was the divorced dad who got him on weekends and holidays and things, but I had zero say over my son's life after that. And at the time, I didn't have a voice. I was too busy people pleasing and doing all of the things to try and make it nice. And, I had no voice, no self-esteem, definitely no worth. And I'm just getting, I'm only sober a couple years. So, I had yet to tap into that. After a few years of now, my feelings are really coming out. And now, this rage, which not only do I have my rage, but I have my dad's rage, my mom's rage. I got all kinds of people's rage coming out of me. So now I'm like a volcano at some point. And when you're a mama who has no say in their child's life, at some point, you're gonna blow. And that definitely happened. And it did land me in a therapist chair, and I was able to dive deep into all of the things I just mentioned, all of the different ways that I've had to self-reflect and build worth and do all of the things that I wasn't, not that weren't modeled, release anger appropriately, give back other people's things that were never mine to carry, all of the things. And I did have a voice, and I used my voice and stuck up for my son in areas, where I could, and it would go falling on deaf ears kind of thing. It was more taken like, thank you for what you think, but we're going to do whatever we need to do, which was really my stepmother. My dad, really, even if he felt like I felt, he would never say it out loud because he has to align with her. She always has to be right. And that's a whole nother conversation. But every time I would bring up a suggestion, it would be like, sorry, that doesn't work for me. Like that, I get when I hear that today, I still get triggered by that sentence in a weird way, not in a like, oh my God, triggered way. But that doesn't work for me was the answer that I received all of the time. And so I would double down and fight harder for him. And at the time, I thought I was advocating for him, right? That I was fighting for him and his rights. Like, if she wouldn't let him do something or whatever, we obviously have two very different parenting styles where she's like helicopter controlled, whatever. It was doing what was best for her, not what was best for my son, what she felt comfortable with. And I wanted to do what was best for my son. And so we clashed over that, and I didn't have power. But what I did recognize at that point is that my son was in the middle of this, right? My son is in the middle of this, and he didn't ask for this. Me, becoming a drug addict and an alcoholic, and them, having to take custody, and this whole thing, is all my doing in essence, right? I have to realize by the look in my son's eyes that he's loyal to her. He loves her. He still loves her. And it's still a thing. It's an underlying thing still to this day. I've healed from a lot of things, but I cannot change who she is as a person. And the fact that he loves her and feels loyal to her, and regardless of how much I hate it, he views her as a second mom. And she would always say to me, like, why don't you get mad at your dad about this kind of stuff? And I was like, well, my dad never tried to be anything other than a grandparent. You stepped in, and if you could erase me from the planet and just have been his mother, that's what you've done. There's very different things in that world. So there was a lot of stuff there. But in the healing, you realize that sometimes, even when you have a voice, you have to not use your voice. So the point of that is like doing what's best for my son is sometimes is shutting my mouth, or in life, sometimes it's better to shut your mouth than it is to open your mouth, even when you have the voice to use, like you have to discern the difference of like pick your battles kind of thing. So I'm sure I'm going on like way longer and had no idea where this conversation was going, but there you go. How's that?
Thanks, Jackie. Thank you for sharing your story. And you brought up a lot of things that I want to touch on. First, let's talk about the generational trauma.
Oh, yeah.
So, when I started learning more about trauma, one of the first things I learned was how trauma can essentially be passed down by eight generations, and how powerful the healing process is with generational trauma. What would you say was the biggest hurdle that you had to overcome that wasn't actually yours?
The biggest hurdle that wasn't actually mine, probably the gaslighting, because I was questioning my life. If you're constantly told, like, that never happened, or I never said, that messes with your psyche. You know what I'm saying? So I feel like that was probably the biggest hurdle in learning how to trust myself, listen to myself, get a sense of self. Because when you're absorbing those, your parents, because every kid absorbs their parents' unhealed stuff, let's face it. Everybody, nobody's exempt from that. Like, it's going to happen, whether they want it to or not, it's going to happen. Having to get a sense of self and untwist all of that, I think, was probably the biggest hurdle. And then, yeah, I think the mind effery surrounding questioning your sanity was definitely the biggest hurdle.
And I can relate to that. I spent a lot of years in environments or relationships where I was gaslit constantly. And it comes to a point where I'm just like, why even bother? Why even try? Because I know that my reality is going to be dismissed, which then leaves me feeling like I don't have a whole lot of power in these environments, simply because it's almost as if I'm not trusted with an opinion, which then has you doubting yourself. And I think it minimizes the way that you show up in environments where you know you're going to get gaslit.
Well, and all right. So it's interesting because no wonder I had no self-esteem. Because if you are constantly gaslit, and I'm not saying like she knew what she was doing, and maybe she did, like that's not for me to say. But what I do know is the corrosiveness of it, like I said, on my psyche. Because when you are gaslit, you're questioning your own thoughts and your own value, you know, your own alignment with whatever you believe in, and you're going against that because, like, maybe they're right because this person is basically your God, right? They're your parents, so you're going against that. Well, maybe they're right, maybe they're right. What's wrong with me? And it's always what's wrong with me. You have zero self-esteem, so coming out of that. And then, of course, every guy I ever dated after that had some kind of sort of trauma or whatever their things are that made them do things like that. And it wasn't the same. Like, they didn't gaslight me like my mom, but it was different. My interactions were different, but the same. My therapist used to be like, I'd be like, oh, guess what? I have a new boyfriend today. My therapist would be, I was like, and this one has a job, you know, or this one brought his wallet to dinner or whatever, you know? And she'd be like, yes, dear. And where is he the same? Because I would always say how he's different. Look, I'm growing. It's different. It's different. But the relationships were always the same because I hadn't healed anything. And until you heal something, you're going to attract what you know. And what I knew was unhealed, unavailable. That's what I knew. And that's, of course, what I attracted. So then I go into people pleasing, wanting to fix, wanted to manage my mom's emotions, wanted to manage and fix the guy's things, wanted to manage and fix my boss's stuff, like, you know, like all of those things. And it wasn't exempt to just men, it was friends, it was whatever. And I would always be the fixer or the whatever trying to do that. But I got into a relationship later when I knew better, when I had healing, when I had whatever, because listen, little like I feel like the word narcissist is very overused in this world as far as that goes. But when somebody is a true blue narcissist, and you know, I could say that that's my mom, but my mom was really just unhealed and un whatever. Like, so I'm not going to label her a narcissist. It's just the pathology of that is what that is. So when somebody is like that and they have to gaslight you, the reason they have to gaslight you is because they need to do that for them, for their own psyche to feel safe or right or whatever that is. I'm not saying it's right. I'm not defending them by any means, but they're doing that because they have to, that's for their own survival. Just like I have to people please and fix for my own survival. That's my reaction to that, right? So we got two sides of the same coin. So now here I know better. I've healed a lot of things, But there's this like sneaky little covert kinds of that personality type that can come into your life in the way of a boyfriend or a job or whatever. And when they come into your life and they're love bombing the crap out of you and they're basically reflecting everything you ever want to hear about yourself to you, of course you're going to drink the Kool-Aid, especially if you're in a low spot. If you're not feeling good about yourself, and you could have self-esteem and worth, but if you're in a spot where, like, maybe you need love, or maybe you need money, if it's a job, or maybe you need the friendship, whatever the vulnerable spot is, and they spot that and they come in covertly, it doesn't matter. Like, you can see overt ones. Some of them are running countries, but the covert ones that come in and they're really nice and everybody likes them and all of that, and then they talk about you behind your back and trash you when they discard you and stuff later. Those are the ones that are still, I'm still vulnerable to that today. And I consider myself to be very smart, I'm very intuitive. I spot things like that a mile away, but sometimes you can't until you do, and you're already in it. And by that time, the point of what I was trying to get up 10 minutes ago was that each one of those gaslighting things where they give you a compliment and then they give you a dig and a compliment and a dig, right? It erodes at whatever self-worth or self-esteem you built. So, like when I was a child, I didn't even have any. So, whatever they were eroding at didn't even exist. But then when I built it after I got sober and you're in relationships with that, and then they erode at it. You really feel it because you're like, where did my self-esteem go? Where is my self-worth? Why am I not like, you are gaslighting me right now and I am out of here, you know, like kind of thing. But then it's like a mind F, like, I should have known better, or why am I still attracting this and what's wrong with me? And then you start shaming yourself all over again about that. And then people don't want to talk about it. Now everybody online's talking about all of these things and labeling them all narcissists. I don't know if that's like helpful and whatever. Real, true blue narcissists that are narcissists, you're never changing. You're never doing anything. The best thing you can do is walk away. Like, they can't have real relationships with anyone at all, ever. It's just impossible. So, and if you have children with them, it's even worse because your children are the ones that are going to suffer. So I don't know where we got off on that tangent, but there you go.
It's okay. I love a lot of the things that you say. And one of the things that I focused on when I wrote my book, Survival Mode Exit Plan, was the survival personas that we pick up. And you talked about it, the people pleasing, the fixing. It becomes part of how we operate as a result of what we had to do to survive. And often it was a huge thing for me to understand where they actually came from, because as I learned more about the personas, I was like, well, I don't just have one. I have them all. And I really don't know where I picked them up from until I dug into it a little deeper. One of the things that for me, I think people pleasing is the hardest one for me to shed completely. And I recognize it's probably one of my first trauma responses in response to what I went through as a child. And then I mastered it. I mastered being able to people please, but sitting in resentment. How have you, sounds like you felt that one, you resonated.
Of course, of course.
How have you managed to navigate through the personas you picked up as a result of the experiences and traumas you've experienced?
Okay, so people pleasing, that's a good one, right? So people pleasing was, me. I was just such a good person. I did all these wonderful things for you, even when you never asked me to. And who asked me to anyway? Most of the time they didn't. I just did them because I was so good. And then I would get resentful, bitter, and whatever, when I wouldn't even get a thank you or an appreciation. And and again, nobody asked me to, but I was being so helpful. So anyway, let's see. 12-step programs definitely help me with the road to people pleasing, right? Because once a relationship bottomed out, as it would, and because I have ADHD, which I didn't find out until later, my rejection sensitivity is like, I feel like I'm gonna die when a relationship doesn't go my way. And people would call me dramatic, but that's a real thing. But I learned in Al-Anon how to say no, right? Because I never could say no because I needed you to love me, you know, please keep me in your life. Don't abandon me. And so Al-Anon showed me how to say no. And then I had to learn how to not only how to say no, but I had to learn how to follow through on the no, because you can learn how to say no, but if people in your life know you're a caver, they're going to keep coming. And that's the problem. I attracted takers. I was the giver, they were the taker. It was a need relationship. It wasn't reciprocal. It was I needed to give for my own survival or safety, and they need to take because that's what they do, because they don't give, and takers do not give. So if you ever think you're going to be in a reciprocal relationship with a taker, it's not going to happen. And what happens is when you start saying no and you start following through on the no, meaning your takers that you've amassed, because you'll have a lot of them and you'll be drained, will, when they realize that they cannot, you will not be giving to them anymore, you have renegotiated their relationship and they are not benefiting from it anymore, they will all leave. And unfortunately, in my case, they all kind of left at one time. So it was like one minute I had 250 people around me, surrounding me, all kinds of, you're awesome, you're this, you're that. And I love that because I needed that reflected back to me because I didn't have any self-esteem. So me doing for them and them telling me how wonderful I was my payoff. The problem was the minute I stopped doing for them, they left. And when they what they left me with was, if I'm not doing something for somebody, then what am I? But that's like the same thing as saying, well, it's I'm going to be in this relationship with this guy because it's better than nothing. And what is that saying? That I'm nothing without it? No. But you have to the people pleasing when they all left, I mean, that really drove me into, oh my God, like abandonment. Talk about abandonment. When they all left, I was like, that kicked it into overdrive. But it also helped me to learn to get a solid sense of self that no matter who left or what happened or what job left or wasn't available anymore or whatever, that I was still going to be okay. I needed to develop that self-worth. You know, that's where the self-care and the self-worth game came in. And really building that up and knowing, and I didn't know this before, that I am perfect being on this planet just now, right now, in this moment, if I never do anything for anyone ever again, that I am worthy. I was put here for a reason, and it wasn't to do for all of you. You know what I'm saying? Especially when I'm not even doing for me at all. So there was lots of lessons in learning how the people-pleasing thing, but the biggest one for me after the abandonment was really building up my own self-worth and knowing that I exist, that I'm worthy, and I was put here for bigger purposes. And reciprocal relationships, and the fact that I will not have any relationship with somebody unless I'm like sponsoring them in 12-step programs, then that's different. Unless they're reciprocal, because if they're not reciprocal, I'm not interested.
Okay. I love a lot of what you said. And when I talk about accident survival mode and being able to take radical ownership of our lives, I always say that it's three phases. It's self-awareness, then reprogramming, and then that reinvention. And you spoke about it a little bit where you've put down these people-pleasing tendencies and now like, who the hell am I without this, right? It's a lot to contend with, but when we get to a place where we can take control back and really map out the things that feel aligned to us, that feel aligned with our goals, aligned with our core values, aligned with our purpose, I think it becomes easier to navigate our healing process and the rebuilding that has to occur after being in survival mode. Now, one of the things that I was going to ask, and you mentioned this, is I was going to ask you how you managed to get through recovery. And you mentioned a 12-step program. And I am going to bring up something that comes up a lot for me. I talk about it a lot, and that's forgiveness, right? Having worked alongside or supported someone who was going through the 12 steps, I am I would say I'm fairly aware of the process. One of the steps, however, is that amendments, and doing so when it's safe to do so. And the reason why I mentioned that in relation to forgiveness is oftentimes in our space, forgiveness is pushed. Forgiveness of others is pushed before forgiveness of self. And I often am very bold in saying you don't need to forgive, because there seems to be this ideation that forgiveness of others is more important than the forgiveness of self. Now, when I say that, I'm not saying don't forgive ever, but I don't always think in relation to trauma that openly forgiving is always safe at every, at particularly at the beginning of the healing process. And I always go back to that step where it's saying make amends only if it's safe for you. And I want to hear your thoughts on openly forgiving when early on in a journey, when it may not necessarily be safe.
Okay, so that's a great question. Okay, so I belong to a couple different 12-step programs, as mentioned, right? So I had to get sober and conscious. So I've been in AA for 27 years. And I gradually, as I bottomed out in relationships, went to Al-Anon and I sponsored Alateen groups and CODA and ACA. They all have different ways of doing things, same steps, different takes. Now, when forgiveness comes up in AA when you're doing the steps. It's all about getting out of self and doing for others and not being selfish and you're being selfish and all of those things. For somebody who's a trauma survivor, this can be a mind F in and of itself. This is almost like gaslighting a trauma survivor because of whatever. But at the time, I still needed it. I still needed to take accountability. I still needed to get sober. I still needed some of it. What wasn't working for me, which is why it led me to Al-Anon when that relationship, I could not step my way out of it when that relationship dissolved and I thought I was going to die, which landed me in a therapist chair eventually. And I learned all of this was that some of the stuff that AA was asking me to do was not safe for me because I didn't even know how to make myself create a safe space within me. And if I can't create a safe space within me, how can I? Go out there and forgive you and do whatever, right? So it's different ways of doing things, but you don't know that until you do. So now I'm in therapy and I'm creating the safe space within me. So, like I said, no matter what's happening on the outside, I'm good. And then when it comes to forgiveness, as I'm working through the traumas, like with my grandfather or my parents or whatever, and you put them in the chair and you do the psychotherapy on them and you put them on trial, find them guilty, and then you got to forgive them kind of thing. And so with forgiveness, that's evolved over time for me, right? Yes, I had to forgive myself and I've forgiven others. I don't know that anybody said, like, you have to forgive them before you forgive you. Like, I don't know that that was my process. Like, there was lots of things I needed to forgive myself for. And I was able to do that even in AA, but some of the bigger ones of forgiveness that I was still holding on to, even until like recently, there's still some that are not gone. The difference is now with time and with whatever the softening of my, my ice cube ways of being stuck in freeze mode, it's melted a lot of that. And so forgiveness is very, looks very different to me than it did before. Before it was because you have to forgive to be able to be free and all of that. But you can want to forgive, but that doesn't mean the forgiveness goes away on its own. Like being willing and it going is two different things because I'm l a living proof of that right now. There's plenty of people on my list, like my stepmother, right? That is something when you have no say in your child's life, that's not going to go away in 5 minutes after 30 years. years of being it thrown in your face and then it being gaslit like you're the problem. That's not going to go away in 5 minutes. The difference is I wasn't willing to even look at forgiveness with that one until maybe a few years ago. And that's a long time. So my son's 35. Now that I'm willing to forgive, it's definitely softened. Like, I don't take this stuff personally. I'm just like, whatever. I have really good days about it and bad days about it. But what I have realized too, right? And this is my own accountability, is let's face it. Yes, would I ever be like this person if I was helping to raise somebody else's child? Heck no. That's not how I would do it. But that's how she does it. And that's in her world. And that's her stuff that whatever she needs to do to keep her safe is how she was with my son. And again, back to the beginning, my son loves her like a mother. So, I've had to view things, and the hardest thing I've had to choke on with the forgiveness thing of her, right? Because it's not really that I have to forgive her at all, right? It has nothing to do with her. It has to do with me, and it has to do with my own. And back to the beginning of our conversation, she is my placeholder for the pain that I couldn't feel for what was too big for me to deal with. And she's just been that placeholder the whole time. So it's not really forgiving her. It's forgiving myself for being an addict, for being a drug addict, for not being able to take care of my son, for having that situation happen at all. But if I'm really to look at it in a bigger world, if you do believe in God, the universe, or whatever it is, and all is in order, this is exactly how my son was supposed, it was supposed to go down this way. All of it for me to learn and evolve and grow. Because believe me, the evolution of hell no, I'll never forgive her for stealing my child to it's a projection of my own pain is a very big, very long, arduous process to get to.
And I think that's a good point, right? I've seen a lot in this space where the forgiveness is pushed. But again, I think it takes time.
Oh, that's a
And I think,
process, girl. That's
yes,
a
it's a
process.
whole process, just like similar to healing, right? Like, I don't believe that there is this destination of healed. I think it's an
Absolutely not.
ongoing process. And I also think the same in relation to forgiveness. And
Yeah.
just like you said, it is often a projection of our own shit.
Right.
You
But
know what I
that
mean?
doesn't mean that I have to, and I can recognize that, but that doesn't mean that I have to, which took a long time too. Like, I don't need to have a relationship there. Like, it was a fake relationship to begin with, never had my best interest, or in my opinion, my son's best interest at heart. So, why would I want to have a relationship there? I don't do that anymore. Like, I'm done pretending, which is awesome. So, even the evolution of that, but sometimes I think we get confused with forgiving the person, forgiving yourself, or whatever, and the fact that you need to have some kind of relationship, because in the amends process in 12-step programs, sometimes when you do amends, it does reconnect the relationship if there was one that was a lifetime relationship. But sometimes it's just to clear the air. And that doesn't mean that you're going to enter into any kind of relationship. And so knowing the difference from that's the, the wisdom to know the difference kind of thing.
And I think it also falls under the umbrella of acceptance as well, right? And
Absolutely.
I've had conversations on this podcast around acceptance. It's not necessarily an agreement. It's the
Absolutely.
reconciliation that this is part of your reality. Jackie girl, I have enjoyed this conversation.
Same,
So
same.
before we wrap it all up, do tell us how we can connect with you online and how you might work with people.
Oh, sure. Okay. So just, we were just talking about I'm always evolving and growing, and I always am a seeker and I want to keep doing. So I am in between my websites, right? The old website is my more spiritual woo old version of myself, which is my name, JackieGrillon.com. And the new one that's in progress right now, but it's pretty well there, is JackieInspires.com.
Okay, we'll make sure all of that information is in the show notes. So before we end the episode today, Jackie, one key takeaway for the audience.
If you do nothing else in your life. Please get a solid sense of self. Please do not let the world tell you who you are.
Yes, that final step for accident survival made that reinvention. Own it. This is your blank canvas and you get to decide. Jackie, thank you so much for your time. Audience, thank you for catching another episode of Survival Mode Disrupted. And I just want to remind you, you were not built to break. You damn sure were not built to just survive. Disrupt the cycle, reclaim your life, and thrive on your own terms. And I will see you next week. Once again, thank you for joining another episode of Survival Mode Disrupted, hosted by the Survival Mode Disruptor, Letitia. You didn't land here by accident. This conversation, it probably cracks something open on purpose, because survival mode isn't just a phase, it's a pattern, an identity, a prison masked as strength. But here's the truth: you're not broken, you're just unfinished. So if something stirred in you today, don't ignore it, don't numb it, move with it. And I want to once again invite you to join Disrupting Survival Mode, the Facebook community where healing is loud and messy and real. I also want to invite you to buy my book, The Survival Mode Exit Plan, because your breakthrough deserves a blueprint. And if you felt seen today, be sure to share this episode with someone who needs to hear it. Like, subscribe, and drop a review. That's how we amplify the voices that need to be heard. And remember, this isn't about fixing yourself. This is about finding yourself again beneath the rubble. Until next time, choose ease, choose power, choose you. This is Survival Mode Disrupted. Let's keep shaking shit up.